In this last session, I thought it might be helpful to give a little bit of advice about how we can integrate this Mahamudra practice into our daily life. And when we talk about integration, often we can talk about integrating three things: view, meditation, conduct. And here, of course, when we talk about view, we're talking about view of reality. And of course, here in the Mahamudra practice, the main view that we were looking at and cultivating was the view of emptiness. But I think as a basis for developing that view, we can also work on at the foundation level, what's called the three marks of existence: the impermanence, dukkha, and no self. Of course, all of us probably have some intellectual appreciation of impermanence. But even though we have, in our modern society, we often tend to relate that to only good things ending. So we often feel as if impermanence is bad news, you know, because all the good things in my life finish. Rather, I think it's more helpful to reflect on the fact of impermanence means possibility for change. That because of impermanence, things can change, we can improve, we can overcome difficulties. I think if we have that positive view of looking at impermanence, then it can really be good news instead of often as we feel impermanence is bad news. That change is possible, that we can improve. And then the second of the three marks was the one, the dukkha. If we reflect on that, particularly the dukkha of change, we can really appreciate that there's none of those pleasurable experiences that we have, none of those things out there that give us pleasure, is really going to give us any sort of lasting, meaningful happiness. And if we can reflect on that, we will hopefully reduce our craving and attachment towards those pleasures and simply enjoy those pleasures more than we do now. And then if we reflect on the all-pervasive dukkha, the deepest level, we can begin to appreciate that the actual underlying source of our suffering is our mental afflictions. And then from that, we can turn our attention inwards and look at ourselves, our own mental afflictions, as really the source of suffering and look to overcome that. So then we can start to develop a healthy aspiration of how we can liberate ourselves from our mental afflictions and suffering. And then the no self, if we can really reflect on that, we can then begin to reduce this self-grasping, believing that somehow there's an autonomous me here. And then, of course, at the deepest level, to reflect on the idea of emptiness, and by reflecting on emptiness, to at the same time reflect on the flip side of emptiness, that emptiness means dependent arising. To really keep those two ideas together. Otherwise, often when we're trying to develop the view of emptiness, we often come to the conclusion, the mistaken conclusion, that nothing really exists, so nothing really matters, there's nothing there. So rather, when we're trying to develop that view of emptiness, to really also continually reflect on the flip side, the dependent arising, that emptiness means dependent arising means emptiness, that everything is interconnected, there's nothing existing independently. So I think that can be helpful when we're approaching this view of emptiness. And of course, when we're developing this view, the philosophical view of reality, as we saw in the text, we need to listen and contemplate, meaning we need to listen to instructions and teachings, we need to read some books, we need to reflect on these ideas to gain a good understanding of these four points. In terms of then reading, there's a few books that can be helpful here. So, of course, I think Mick has sent you all the PDF of the Gelug Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra, the book from His Holiness Dalai Lama, so you've already got that. In terms of the preliminary practices, the foundation practices, particularly in terms of those four guiding instructions, the refuge bodhicitta, the Vajrasattva mandala, guru yoga, if you want to sort of get an appreciation of those in a good way, I think a good book there is a book from Zongsa Kense called Not for Happiness. Not for Happiness. And he talks about these sort of four preliminary practices there. And then in terms of the shamatha practice, I think a very good book, and the one I've been referring to a number of times in this retreat, Attention Revolution from Alan Wallace. And of course in this, and he goes through the various different objects in that book, and he also has the Four Immeasurables practices in there, the Tonglen, and also a little bit of dream, lucid dreaming in the book as well. Of course, in this Mahamudra retreat, we are mainly focusing on the mind and resting in awareness. So if you want to simply focus on that in shamatha practice, then also Alan Wallace has another book called Stilling the Mind. Stilling the Mind. And that's focusing on the shamatha practice, using the mind as the object. So that's a very good book for that. In terms of Vipassana practice, of course, we were mainly looking at this wisdom of emptiness. As I already mentioned, I think a very good book to look at as a beginning point for this is How to See Yourself as You Really Are from His Holiness Dalai Lama. Very good introductory book, clearly written, explaining a lot of these ideas about emptiness and dependent arising and ignorance and so forth. How to See Yourself as You Really Are. And then on that basis, if you want to go a little bit deeper into the emptiness practice, there's a couple of books that I think can be very helpful. There's one called Introduction to Emptiness by Guy Newland. And he is there introducing emptiness based on Tsongkhapa's presentation of emptiness in the Lam Rim, which of course was the basis of our Vipassana presentation here. So he introduces that in a very sort of digestible way. So I think that can be a good book. Another, Guy Newland, Newland, N-E-W-L-A-N-D, Guy, G-U-Y. Another good book I find is How to Realize Emptiness by Gen Lam Rimpa. Gen Lam Rimpa, How to Realize Emptiness. That's also very clearly written, I find. And then if you want to go in a little bit more detail, again, based on the Lam Rim on Tsongkhapa's presentation, a book that came out a couple of years ago is called Insight into Emptiness by Khensur Jumpa Tekchok. Maybe I'll put that name on the board. So that's also a very well, clearly written book, again, based on the presentation that we have here in this text, again, through Lama Tsongkhapa. In terms of Mahamudra practice, in terms of the Mahamudra practice as it's coming down through the Kagyu lineage, there's a couple of books, I think, that can be very helpful. One written by a sort of modern-day Kagyu practitioner is called Mind at Ease. Mind at Ease. And it's by Tralek Gyapgon. So I find that is a very good book. Insight into Emptiness. And another book, and in general I find also another great modern day Kagyu master, Trungu Rinpoche. He has many books, and generally his books are very well written. And the book in particular that gives good practical advice is called Crystal Clear. Crystal Clear. And then if you want a more technical book that has a lot of the technical background, that book I read from a couple of times in this retreat, Pointing Out the Great Way by Daniel P. Brown. Pointing Out the Great Way. So that's a good sort of like reference book for a lot of the technical background. And he's written it, he's taken in the Kagyu tradition in the Tibetan, there's mainly three main classic Kagyu texts that a lot of the Kagyu traditions draw on. And he synthesized those three in this book. And also he has a little bit of a Western psychology perspective of that as well. So I find that also fairly good reference material. But it is quite in-depth and technical, but I think written in a good way. So that's some books that you might like to read. Now then, in terms of meditation, we saw there that in meditation, we talked first about preparation. One of the aspects of preparation was actually even to prepare ourselves well for meditation in terms of those six prerequisites. And in particular there, one that I really emphasize a lot, and that is one of those conditions was, in terms of supportive environment, was good friends, or the idea of sangha. And that's something that I know from personal experience and from talking to many people, one of the reasons why people find it very difficult to meditate and integrate things into their life, because they go home full of enthusiasm and really want to meditate and integrate into their life, but somehow they can't manage to start because they just get swept up in their old habits. And that happened to me, I know from personal experience. When I first came into Buddhism, very enthusiastic, went home, wanted to really change my life and head in a new direction, but I just got swept up in my old routines because there was no one around me who was interested in this, no Buddhist centres or anything. And basically for 2 years, nothing happened. Even though I wanted it to change, I wanted to go in a new direction, I wasn't strong enough to work against all of the conditions around me that were driving me in the opposite direction. So I think for many of us, that's going to be a challenge. And so I think very important is to find sangha, spiritual community. Nowadays, of course, it's much easier to find that than, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And that can take the form of course, of a Buddhist center or simply a group of people. So I really encourage you to try to find that sangha in where you live. And I think you'll find it's going to be very helpful. You can get support and you can support them. So I really recommend at least on a weekly basis to get together in a group situation, maybe a little bit of meditation or discussion together, get some support, feel like you're not the only one who's trying to do this, and that's going to be very helpful. So that's something I really tend to emphasize a lot. And then, of course, in terms of preparation within the meditation, we talked about preparing body, speech, and mind. So again, having a good posture so we can forget about the body. Speech, just allowing the breathing to flow naturally. And then preparing the mind, bringing it into the present moment. And then also, of course, setting a positive motivation for the meditation. So here, of course, in the Mahamudra practice, belonging to the Mahayana tradition, then, of course, that motivation is bodhicitta. So try to set best possible motivation in our meditation. And try to include others in your motivation. Often in our life, if we're doing something and we only have a motivation regarding ourselves, it may be a good motivation, but the motivation is like, I would like to get some benefit out of this, then often if that activity gets very difficult, then we tend to just give up. Whereas if in our motivation we've included others, meaning I'm doing this not just for my benefit, but for the benefit of others, then even if things get a little bit difficult, often we'll persevere because we're doing it also for others. So I find that including others in our motivation can be really helpful to be persevering and also giving us a lot of positive energy. So keep that in mind in any sort of motivation in meditation or daily life. And then, of course, in the actual meditation, we saw to cultivate preliminary practices, the foundation practices for Mahamudra, if we want that to be effective. And there we saw that the initial preliminaries or foundation practice, these four thoughts that turn the mind. So Here, in particular, if we find ourselves being very lazy when it comes to meditating, then often it's because we don't appreciate the opportunities we have. We don't appreciate our precious life, precious human life, and we don't appreciate that this is not going to last forever. So if we can really reflect on precious human life and the fact it's not going to last forever, then we're going to see what a wonderful opportunity we have, and we're going to want to take advantage of that. And then we're not going to be lazy. We're not going to waste our life. And then, of course, if we find a lot of craving and attachment for pleasurable things coming in to our meditation and life in general, then what's very good to meditate on here in the foundation practices is impermanence. Because if we can really see things as constantly changing and flowing, then it's much harder to generate attachment or craving for any pleasant experience. So often in the text it says the antidote to craving and attachment is to reflect on impermanence. Internalize it. And then, of course, the other thing we can reflect on in terms of craving and attachment is the idea of dukkha, the dukkha of change, that these pleasurable experiences are just temporary, transient experiences. They're never going to fulfill us. And that can help to reduce craving and attachment as well. So that's some of the foundation practices that we can work on. And then, of course, in the Mahamudra, we have the two main practices of Shamatha and Vipassana. So in the Shamatha practice, we saw here in the Mahamudra approach that we are focusing on the mind, either observing the mind and all thoughts or simply resting in awareness. And what we saw there was that both of these practices, often we can people find very challenging because it's quite subtle, the practice, but enormous benefit. Because if we can use the mind as the object of Shamatha practice and observe all our thoughts and emotions and so forth, then we're really going to become the masters of our mind instead of the slaves of our mind, not tormented by our mind. We're going to find that our mind will become our best friend instead of our worst enemy. And then also the resting in that awareness practice, we can really rest in the stillness of mind. And if we get used to that, then we can still stay in that open, spacious, still state in the midst of all of our activities in daily life without getting caught up in the appearances. And also by resting in awareness and also sometimes observing the mind as a shamatha practice, sometimes we can come to an intuitive experience of the nature of the mind. So this is vipassana. So both of them lend themselves to easily leading into the vipassana practice. Now, even though we may want to do these practices, we may find that we can't even start to get into them, then what is often recommended as a starting point is go back to the breath. One of those three variations of the breath practice, full body, abdomen or nostrils, to help relax, to help stabilize the mind, to help make the mind a little bit more clear. Then once we've achieved a little bit of stability and clarity of mind through that, then we can move into using the mind or resting in awareness as the object of our shamatha practice. And then, of course, in the vipassana practice, we looked at emptiness practice. But again, I think it's very helpful here, also in our vipassana practice, to work on the impermanence, dukkha, and no self as a basis can be very helpful. Because actually, if we really come to meditate on impermanence and come to really taste and experience impermanence, this is actually very close to realizing emptiness. So this can be a very good basis and a help for our emptiness practice. And then, of course, within the emptiness practice, as we saw in this text, it's often very much recommended to begin by focusing on ourselves as a person. How do I exist? Is there this independent me here that seems to be here? And then we can, once we become a little bit familiar with this practice, we can then expand that out to, you know, is there a mind here? Is there a findable mind? What about the body? Is there a independently existing body here? And then we can move out to other phenomena as well. Of course, it's very important that we balance the shamatha vipassana practice with the compassion wing of practice, Because here, if we don't do that, both the shamatha and vipassana practice tend to be very focusing inwards, and we can really become quite self-absorbed. So it's very important to keep that balance, to keep that connection. And also in the compassion wing, we're developing a lot of positive energy and motivation for doing the practice. So you'll find there'll be balance, plus you'll find a lot of positive energy and motivation to do the practice. And so here we saw as a foundation the four immeasurables practices: loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. But we saw in those practices that each one of them can sort of become polluted and degenerate. So if our loving kindness practice is simply degenerating into attachment, or we find a lot of attachment coming in, then to reflect on equanimity as the antidote. And if we find that our equanimity practice is just degenerating into being equally indifferent and apathetic towards others, then to reflect on compassion, to get that close connection with others. And if we reflect too much on compassion, often that can degenerate into this sort of sense of hopelessness and despair. It's all too much. Then we need to balance that by focusing on the positive aspects. So that's empathetic joy, rejoicing in the virtues of ourselves and others. Sometimes that rejoicing can degenerate into just rejoicing about meaningless things and even rejoicing about others' suffering. So if that happens, then reflecting on loving kindness, the wish for ourselves and others to have genuine happiness. So these are practices that I think can be very helpful to balance our practice. And then, of course, in terms of meditation, the key to success, of course, is continuity. It means to have a daily regular practice. And also, it's very much recommended to meditate the same time every day. Because if we keep changing the time when we meditate, we're not really developing a habit. And one of the most difficult things with meditations is simply just developing the habit. So if we meditate at the same time every day, then it becomes a habit. It becomes easier to actually do it. And within the meditation, of course, as I mentioned a few times, quality over quantity. Don't try and meditate too much. Because if you try and meditate too long, the latter part of your meditation, you're just going to fall into dullness and distraction. So keep your session short. If you want to meditate longer each day, break it into shorter sessions, many short sessions. And also, it's very helpful to have a fixed amount of time that you meditate. So you can have like a timer, your mobile phone or a clock or something that has a timer. Because if we don't have a timer, what often happens is that on days where you're meditating and it's very difficult, maybe you're a very negative state of mind, very sleepy, and you're trying, and after 5 or 10 minutes it's just too difficult, then often what we do is we just give up. And that's not really a good thing to happen, because one of the things we really need to cultivate in the spiritual path is perseverance. And if every time something gets difficult we give up, we're not going to get very far. So if we have a timer, even on days where it's quite difficult, we're going to persevere. So that's going to be good to develop perseverance. And then on other days, if we don't have a timer and things are going really well, what we often tend to do is we just keep meditating because it's going well. But then what we do is we tend to keep meditating until it starts to go not so well, and then we stop. And the thing we remember most about meditation is how it ended. So if we're always ending in frustration or dullness or distraction, then we're going to start to associate meditation with not such good experiences. We're not going to want to meditate again. Whereas if we have a timer and things are going well, and the timer goes and we stop, that's what we remember, that it went well. And then we'll be enthusiastic to meditate again the following day. Of course, the amount of time you meditate, as we go deeper into the practice, we will need to extend that slowly to continue to progress. And also, of course, on top of meditation, what's very much recommended is to do regular retreat, maybe once or twice a year to go to a retreat. And as a beginner, it's very much recommended to do group retreat rather than solitary retreat. Because solitary retreat as a beginner tends to be very difficult. We have to be self-motivating. We have to keep to some sort of schedule. So it's very difficult as a beginner to keep to some sort of schedule and to be self-motivating. Whereas if you go to a group retreat, there's structure there, you just turn up, and then there's the group energy as well. So it's much easier as a beginner to follow in a group retreat. So that's what I would recommend in the beginning stages, is to attend some group retreats. And then slowly, slowly, we can start to do a little bit more simple personal retreat and start short, maybe the first time, maybe 2 or 3 days. And then slowly we can work up to a week, and then slowly we can do more than that. So this is how we can go into retreat, group and then personal retreat. So that's a little bit about meditation. And then, of course, practice is meditation plus what we do outside of meditation. So the third point is conduct, how we can conduct ourselves in daily life to continue the practice. And the one point I've already mentioned here is the idea of sangha. I think if we really want to be able to do something and move forward, we need that sangha. We need the spiritual community to support us, and we support them. If we try to do it on our own, my experience and the many experience of many people I talk to, it's really very, very difficult. Of course, if we're a very strong-minded person, then maybe we can do that sort of on our own. But most of us, as a beginner, tend to be easily influenced by people and things around us. And often we're influenced in not such good ways in terms of our old habits. And then it's hard to move in a new direction in our life. And as part of that, we need to simplify our life. That was one of the prerequisites for the shamatha, the few activities. Now, the reality is, of course, many of us have very busy lives. You know, our life is full of activities. And of course, some of those are necessary. Most of us probably need to work to earn some money to have a roof over our head and feed ourselves. And maybe some of us also have family responsibilities and maybe a couple of other responsibilities. But beyond those essential activities, then we tend to fill up our day with lots of other stuff. Because often in our modern society, it's felt that if we're not doing something, we're not being productive. So let's just do anything, just do something. And then, of course, if we're not doing anything, we're just sitting there quietly, then, like I think the analogy I gave about the people in the room that couldn't sit quietly, they just shocked them. Did I talk about? Yeah. So, you know, therefore, if we sit quietly, we have to look at a state of our mind, and it's a mess, so we just distract ourselves. We've got to do something. Now, of course, what we can do is force things out of our life, cut things forcibly out, but then it's always going to be a struggle. You know, push it out, it comes back, push it out, comes back. So rather, as I've briefly mentioned before, what can be very helpful here is to reflect on precious human life and death. If we really reflect on those, we're going to really appreciate the preciousness of our life, and it's not going to last forever. And then we're going to start to see how some of these extra activities that we fill up our life with are completely meaningless. They're not bringing us anything. We're not going to want to waste our time on these activities. And then we're just going to lose interest. Then suddenly we're going to have some time and space and energy to meditate and do more meaningful things in our life. There was a lady, an Australian lady, who was working in the hospice movement for 30 years. And then over those years, she asked people she was caring for, what their biggest regret in life was. And she made a list of the top 5 regrets. It's readily available on the internet. Number 1 regret, the top regret, was regretting having worked so hard and not spending time with family and doing other things. That was the number 1 regret. So we don't want to, you know, waste our life and be full of regrets later. And so if we reflect on precious human life and death, I think then we can shift our perspective in a more meaningful way. You know, a little bit like the Steve Jobs quote I gave, you know, that he reflected on that every day. And It helped him to make the important decisions in life and prioritize his life. And then, of course, as a basis for our conduct, as we've seen a number of times in this text, ethical lifestyle. And again, in all of our conduct, then if we can bring the two wings of wisdom and compassion into all of our conduct, is the best. In any situation, try to bring in wisdom and conduct in terms of how to respond to that situation. And as we saw in this retreat, is that often one of the reasons we react in a negative way towards others, particularly when they're behaving badly, is that we do this cognitive fusion. So if someone's behaving badly, rather than simply seeing there's a person doing a harmful, negative behaviour, we tend to see them as a bad person. And then we end up often attacking the person, getting angry, and we tend to do that with ourselves as well. So if we can, in these situations, if there's some negative behaviour going on, whether it's others or ourselves, to avoid this cognitive fusion. Then we can have compassion for ourselves and others, and we can work at helping them to overcome their negative behaviour, and we can work at overcoming our own negative behaviour. And then we can still feel good about ourselves and not end up in this guilt and low self-esteem. And again, also related to that, when we enter into difficult situations, then to have a good perspective of those, because often when we enter into a difficult situation, we have the perspective, problem, I don't like that, please go away. And so then we have aversion. So when we have aversion to difficult situations, of course, we simply magnify them, and then they become bigger and bigger and bigger, and we become overwhelmed by them, and often then we react in not a very constructive way to try to get rid of that problem. So rather than see that difficult situation as a problem, see it as an opportunity. Okay, here's a difficult situation. What can I do with this to move forward? Because actually, if we look at our life, the times when we often most developed as a person is when we faced with difficult situation. If our life is sort of flowing along very easily, no difficulties, we often tend to stagnate. We don't tend to really develop. When we're faced with a difficulty, it forces us, it challenges us to overcome it, to improve, to overcome it. So if we can see difficult situations as opportunities, of course they're still going to be difficult, but at least we won't magnify the difficulty, we won't be so easily overwhelmed by it, and we can use that as fuel for our own development. Practical advice on this aspect is very much one of the main key elements of the Lojong, or mind training approach, that Lama Ritisha brought into Tibet. And then, of course, with all of those things in terms of conduct, one of the key elements, if we want to implement those things, is we need mindfulness. It's all well and good to say we're going to do all these things in daily life, but the reality is that if we don't have mindfulness, then simply when we're faced with a situation, before we know it, we've reacted out of old habit. Even though we want to have different perspective and respond in a different way, it's very difficult to change because we don't have mindfulness. So that's why the shamatha practice is very helpful, because it helps us to increase our mindfulness so that we have a little bit of an opportunity then, when a situation rises, instead of reacting out of habit, to have a little window of opportunity to look at that situation differently and respond in a different way and start to slowly change the way in which we respond. So its key factor is the mindfulness. And then in terms of a daily practice sort of based on the Mahamudra is, again, meditation. It's very much recommended to meditate first thing in the morning, because usually that's the time where we're most fresh. It's usually most quiet where we are living, and also it's a very good way to start the day. So if possible, is to do the meditation first thing in the morning. And again, then to set a good motivation, try to include others in our motivation. And within that practice, we looked at here in the Mahamudra, Shamatha Vipassana. So again, we can, if we find that we're really very dull and distracted, then it's good as a beginner to emphasize the Shamatha practice. Again, here Mahamudra, observing the mind, resting in awareness. But then also, of course, to engage in some Vipassana practice, either looking at ourselves as a person, or as we did in the awareness practice, asking questions of the awareness, you know, to try to find out if this awareness has any findable existence. So that's space-like emptiness practice, of course, in the morning. And then, of course, in the daytime, we need to continue to cultivate mindfulness for the shamatha practice. So one way we can cultivate mindfulness through the day, of course, is to use what's called triggers. Of course, it's good to try to be as mindful as possible throughout the day, but at our level, it's very helpful if we have some reminder occasionally to be mindful. And here, we can use modern technology to help us. There are many apps now that do that function, that you can program so that regular intervals throughout the day, you'll get some alarm or something, and then when that happens, you just stop whatever you do, and then for a very short time, you do a little mindfulness exercise. It may be simply focus on your breathing for 3 breaths. And you may find that you might find that even doing that maybe just once an hour or once every 2 hours, you'll find that you're going to start to get more in the habit of being normal, instinctively in a very mindful state. So that's something that can help us. And then, of course, in terms of Vipassana practice, this illusory-like emptiness practice that we mentioned. And that is, whenever we receive appearances, is question appearances, to really understand that things are not existing as they appear, that what is appearing to me seems to exist independent of me, but based on my understanding and meditation, I know that things are not existing as they appear. This is very helpful, particularly in situations where we react with attachment aversion, where we have pleasant and unpleasant experiences. And to, in those situations, is to look at the object or person that's provoking the pleasant experience or unpleasant experience and look for the attractiveness or unattractiveness in that object. And if we can do that, we'll come to realize that that person or thing is not attractive or unattractive from its own side. We are creating that through our particular experience. In that way, you'll find that when you're having a pleasant experience, you can reduce your attachment and you can actually enjoy the pleasant experience more. And if it's an unpleasant experience, you can avoid the aversion and making it a bigger unpleasant experience than it is. So that's something we can do in terms of illusory-like emptiness through the day. At the end of the day, I think it's also good to finish the day on a good note. Of course, if we have time and energy to dedicate to another meditation session at the end of the day, very good. If we don't, maybe we got busy social calendar or we're quite tired or something in the evening, then at least what we can do before we go to sleep is 2 things. One very helpful thing to do is to, at the end of the day, reflect on our day. How did our day go? And then if we notice any particular heavy negative things we did, said, or did during the day, we can go through those 4 opponent powers. We can develop sincere regret. We can reaffirm the positive direction in our life. We can think of some sort of practical remedy for that and then make a strong determination not to do it again. In that way, we can really weaken those negativities in our mind and weaken the habit of engaging in those negativities. So that's something very good to do at the end of the day. Also, of course, maybe even more important, because we have such a big focus on the negative in our life, that to balance that, to focus on the positive. So then also to reflect on our day, how did our day go? And look at any good things we did during the day, said or did during the day, And then rejoice, be happy about having done that, and then make a strong determination to continue to do that the following day. In that way, we can strengthen our positive habits, and then we can start to have a balanced view of ourselves instead of always focusing on the negative. So that's one thing we can do at the end of the day. The other thing we can do is when we go into bed, and this is a little bit what we did here in the end of each day in the retreat, is go into the Shavasana, corpse posture, when you go to bed. And then focus on sensations throughout the body. So this is a shamatha practice, mindfulness practice. And also then releasing any tension in the body and mind. And often if we've had a very busy, hectic day at work, often there is a bit of residue of tension in the body and the mind from all the things that happened during the day. So we can release those. And then also, and then we can do that as long as we can maintain some alertness. Once we start to get drowsy, then just mentally note, okay, my meditation's finished now, and then move out of that Shavasana into whatever posture you use for sleep. So then if you associate Shavasana just with meditation, then you're going to find over time you can be in that Shavasana posture and be quite relaxed and quite alert. So this can also be a very good way to transition into sleep. So that's something we can do at the end of the day. And then just a couple more points related to these three elements of integration is the first is, of course, we need to apply effort in all three areas. If we don't apply any effort, if we're very lazy, then, of course, nothing's going to change. And as part of applying effort, then it needs to be not sort of a lot of effort and then no effort and then a lot of effort and no effort, but continuous effort. Continuity is the key to success. And we need to be careful in this effort that we don't turn it into like some sort of hardship. Often what people do is they see that meditation and doing these things is like a hardship, so they sort of grit their teeth and try and push through this. This is not... We've missed the point completely if we have this type of effort. Because what we're looking at here is practices and behaviours that are going to improve our life. And so therefore, we should be happy to do these things. So therefore, effort, as it's called in Buddhism, is joyous effort. So effort is defined as delighting in virtue. If we delight in doing something, then it actually really becomes effortless. We're not sort of seeing it as some sort of hardship. So as much as possible in any of these areas, if we can keep that joyous mind, to see, have that joyous effort, even if it's a difficult situation, to see it as an opportunity, then we can still have a joyous mind, understanding here's an opportunity to move forward. And if we can keep that joyous mind, it makes everything a lot easier and we can have move forward much more easily. And together with that joyous effort, to practice patience, to drop expectation. Often in our modern society, of course, you know, we want it and we want it now. We've got to have it now, now, now. So we often go into all these sorts of things with a lot of expectation, you know, that, oh, my practice this week, my meditation's got to be at least as good as last week. It must be better. Or I must be, where am I on the path? I have to get to this fourth stage by next week or next month, you know. I have to get there by then, you know. If we have these sorts of expectations, then we're going to get simply frustrated. And that's a form of grasping, of craving and attachment. And that's just going to block our progress. So, yes, we need to know the goal, and yes, we need to know the steps we need to go through to move forward toward that goal, but then we drop all expectation and simply work in the present moment. Because if we bring in expectation, then we're just going to get frustrated and we're going to get blocked in terms of progress. So just drop all expectations. And then we need to also have balance in terms of inner development and outward activities, outer activities. We need that balance. How that balance looks like will vary from individual to individual. And within an individual, that will probably vary over time. So sometimes we need to emphasize inner development. So we spend more time developing ourselves, maybe even go into some sort of retreat for a little while. At other times, we may need to emphasize outer expression. And so then we really need to go out and implement these things in daily life. And here, related to that, we need to understand sometimes when people start to engage in some sort of spiritual practice, they often come up with this dilemma, you know, should I do the career thing or should I do the spiritual thing? And so then they're going, well, if I don't do the career thing, you know, I won't get any money, but I don't know. So then people have this doubt and this dilemma. I think this is a wrong way of thinking. Because if we abandon our career, then again, for many of us, how are we going to financially support ourselves? And then also, what are we going to do? Are we going to sit in a cave for the rest of our life and meditate? I think that's not going to work. And then we've got no way of expressing ourselves, because particularly if in the career we've chosen, that's where we have some talent, we're good at it, then we've given up the one thing that we're good at that we can benefit society with. So rather than seeing them as a choice, we need to integrate. So if you're in a career where you have some ability and talent, use that talent and make your career as meaningful as possible to benefit society as much as possible. Like an example of this, I had a couple of years ago, I had a man came to me and he came with this dilemma. And he said he was in marketing. He didn't tell me what he was marketing, but probably something not very useful. And he said that he was very good at marketing, and that's why he had a well-paid job and so forth. But he saw that going there, he really didn't have much meaning in his life. And so then he had this dilemma. And I said, well, no, just integrate, you know. You know, obviously you're very good at marketing, so use your talent and skill in marketing and market something useful to society in that way. So I think many of us, maybe we are in a job and the way we're functioning there now, it doesn't seem like it's much meaning and much benefit. But often we can find that even within the job we have, we can sort of shift our perspective to make it more meaningful for ourselves and for society. Now, of course, if you've gone into a job that you've only gone into it to make money and you don't like doing it and really has no benefit to society, then maybe we can think about actually doing something that we really want to do. So, you know, if we really have some heart desire of how to use our talents to benefit society, then if we're not doing that, then I think it's maybe useful to think about that possibility. But of course, if we are in a family situation and we have financial responsibility to others, then it would be irresponsible just to give up stuff and not take care of those responsibilities. So we have to factor that in, of course, as well. I think that's it. Okay. Okay, just one or two more points, and then maybe if you want to ask some last questions. In terms of doing retreat and so forth, in terms of retreats coming up, anyone's interested, I've been referring to Alan Wallace a number of times. Myself and a couple of people here in this retreat are going to his 8-week retreat that starts in a few weeks' time in Italy. And with that retreat, he's going to be doing also Shamatha Vipassana Mahamudra and a little bit of Dzogchen. And with those retreats, they upload the audio sessions, so they have these sort of podcasts. So you could, if you wanted to, follow these. It's an 8-week retreat, but there's only 2 sessions a day. So, and the podcasts are on. SBInstitute.com, SantaBarbaraInstitute.com, that's his organization. And the retreat starts at the end of the month. So if you're interested, you can have a listen to those. He's also in June doing a one-week shamatha retreat in Sammy Ling. It's a monastery, Buddhist centre in Scotland. So that's in, I think, the last week in June. And then someone mentioned, and I mentioned this idea of the four philosophical schools, the Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Chittamatra, Madhyamika, and that I'll be teaching in those in more detail in London at the Jamyang Centre in June. So that's over two long weekends, from 17th to 19th of June, the first weekend, the following weekend, 24th to 26th of June. So anyone's interested in that, then Jamyang Centre in London. And then, of course, I'm going to be coming back here again in July, July 9 to 17, and that's also going to be a Shamatha Vipassana Mahamudra retreat, similar to this one. In July, I'll be using a different text. I'll be using actually a more Kagyu text by Karma Chakmi. So that's going to be the basis of that retreat. But it'll be covering the same sort of areas of Shamatha Vipassana Mahamudra. So that's in July. So that's just a few things about retreats and teachings coming up. And for this retreat, I'm recording everything. So I'm going to make the audio available. I'm going to upload it to probably Dropbox, and then I'm going to send the link to Mick, and then Mick will send the link out to you, and then you can download that if you wish. So that should probably happen within the next week or so. And also, I have my own website. GlennSvensson.org. So I've uploaded some other teachings and retreats and stuff there, and some materials as well. So if you find anything useful on that website, help yourself. And also on that website, I have a contact page. So if you want to ask me any questions in future, you can send me a message and I'll try and help you in any way I can. So that's all I wanted to say. So maybe any last questions before we wrap up this session? Yes, sometimes there's a presentation of the 20 emptinesses or 16 emptinesses, and one of those is emptiness of emptiness, yes. So emptiness is also empty of inherent existence.
So that means it's produced?
No. The pen, for example, is produced. It's produced through causes and conditions. When the pen comes into existence, simultaneous with that, of course, we have the emptiness of the pen, the fact that the pen is empty of independent existence. So when the pen comes into existence, simultaneous, we have the emptiness of the pen. But that emptiness is not produced through causes and conditions. So because emptiness is not something floating in the air, yeah, you can only have emptiness with respect to phenomena. Emptiness is a quality of all phenomena. So when a phenomena comes into existence, then, of course, the fact that it's empty of independent existence, that quality is there. So whenever a phenomena is produced, then we have that quality, just like all the other qualities of that phenomena. So emptiness of a phenomena is coexistent with the phenomena, but it's not, emptiness is not produced through any causes and conditions itself. So it's what's called permanent phenomena. But here we need to be careful of the word again. When we hear that emptiness is a permanent phenomena, often people feel or think, oh, that means it lasts forever. In the Buddhist text, when you see the word permanent, it's not talking about how long something lasts. It's simply talking about the fact, is this thing changing from one moment to the next? So anything that doesn't change from one moment to the next is permanent. The word in Tibetan and Sanskrit literally is unchanging. And that's what's translated as permanent. And the other word is changing. And that's what's translated as impermanent. So impermanent is simply saying this thing is changing moment by moment. Permanent is saying this thing is not changing moment by moment. So neither of those two are indicating whether this is going to exist for a long time or a short time. Yeah. Yeah, so again, as a beginner, of course, we're going to have a lot of mental content there. And so that's going to be easy to see that the mind's changing. And then as we improve in that practice, that threshold will go down. And so we're going to even start to pick up more subtle mental activity and even shorter mental activity. So that's also going to help improve to understand that the mind is changing moment by moment. And then if we can understand that these thoughts are an expression of the mind, then the analogy is like the ocean and the waves. So that we can see that these waves are constantly moving and that they're not something other than the mind, the ocean. So then in we saw this mixing of movement and stillness. Mixing of movement and stillness. So then we can understand that the mind is also just a flow. And within that flow, sometimes there's movement and sometimes not. But it's a flow, yeah, over time.
Sure. For example, you can step from Corinthians, you can step into the same river for the second time.
Second
time, you are not the same and river is
not
the same. But things like in quality, for example, if you look at the stillness of the mind, the stillness is always the same. And you can be pretty aware of that the stillness is always there.
Yeah.
No matter if there are
Yes, the fact that the mind is still is not changing. Just like the fact that the water is wet is not changing, isn't it? I mean, it's not like the water is wet sometimes and not other times. But then in the river, we can say it's the same wetness at 10 o'clock and the same wetness at 12 o'clock, isn't it?
That's
the same thing.
That's
the same thing. Correct. So stillness is a quality of the mind that's not changing. Wetness is a quality of water that's not changing. But the water's changing and the mind is changing.
But I understand the mind as something what I can feel, other than wetness or stillness or some other ideas. But the mind, for me, is like something what is present. And seems not to change when it's in stillness.
Yeah. So then,
how to experience that, and
that is exactly what the Shamatha and Vipassana practice are about. In the Shamatha practice, we get to see more and more clearly the conventional nature of the mind, and then in Vipassana practice, we get to see the empty nature of the mind. So these questions will be directly answered in the shamatha vipassana practice.
So maybe that's no need to understand the impermanence of the mind, only maybe you should see its emptiness.
I think you will get to see impermanence of the mind in your practice. So what I can suggest is have a look and see. Yeah, then we need to slowly wrap it up.
Yesterday you talked about literally like
empty, yeah.
And that breathing practice, and there was an analogy with a lucid dream.
Yeah.
And I thought about that in a lucid dream, you kind of, maybe it's very interesting for the first time, but after you start to feel like a little bit lonely there. Because
lonely.
You understand that everything you see around, like those nice flowers or something like that, it's only something your mind is producing right now.
But isn't the dream me also illusory? As well as the dream people? I mean, isn't the dream person have the same level of existence as the...
If we use the same analogy for this normal reality, so how to overcome that indifference which could come from that?
Because again, to understand that the dream me has the same level of existence as the dream world. So here in this emptiness practice, we're not saying that the only real thing is my mind, because everything's coming from my mind. So everything else is just a figment of my imagination. So I'm the only existent thing in the world, and everything else is just nothing. That's a wrong understanding, because what we haven't done there is we haven't applied the same investigation on ourselves. And this is where often the Chittamatra system, the mind-only system, come to this conclusion. In the Chittamatra system, they say, well, not exactly this, but they say that because everything's coming from the mind, the only real thing is my mind. But they are not what you're describing here is called solipsism. Solipsism is I'm the only thing that exists. Everything else is just a figment of my imagination. So Chittamatra would not say that, but they would say that there is no external material world. It seems like there is, but it's not. It's internal to the mind. So the Majjhimikas criticize the Chittamatra and saying, what you haven't done is you've correctly applied your investigation to the world to see there's no independent world, but you haven't applied the same investigation to yourself. So that's what the Majjhimikas would criticize the Chittamatrans. So what we can say here is that if we have this feeling, what we're probably happening is we are correctly negating an independent world, but then we're not focusing on the me. We're still holding on to there's an independent me, and so everything else is just a figment of my imagination. So then turn our attention to me, the person, or this mind, and then you'll probably end up with the same result. That's what's often said. Okay, any very last question? Otherwise, we'll finish there. Last question.
Buddhism uses the concept of
attachment. So I didn't catch the beginning?
In Buddhism,
Buddhism?
We use the concept of attachment. There's another term, addiction.
Addiction. Yeah, I mean, often we don't see that word in the Buddhist context, but I think we can understand it simply as a very strong form of attachment, that its basis is within attachment. So again, normally we don't see that sort of word in the Buddhist text, but I think that's how we can sort of understand that. Within, you know, the attachment and aversion, they are the sort of the the sort of basis, you know, either this wanting or this not wanting, and that both of those can manifest in different ways and different levels and at different extremities. Like the aversion could manifest as mild irritation, it could manifest as being annoyed, it could manifest as anger, it could manifest as resentment, as hatred. All of these are manifestations of the underlying not wanting. And the wanting can manifest as clinging, craving, addiction, obsession, all of these things, desiring, wanting, expectation. All of these things are sort of coming from that same wanting. They're just different flavors. So Buddhism often goes to what's underneath all of these manifestations. And that's why we talk about the attachment in terms of the wanting and the aversion, not wanting. So that's usually the level of the explanation. Okay, we'll stop there. So I'd just like to finish by thanking Tet for organising this retreat here. And of course, behind the scenes, Mick, who you probably many of you have communicated with. Also to thank Mick. And also I'd like to thank the staff here for providing this wonderful environment for us in the retreat. And then lastly, I'd like to thank all of you for making the time and effort to come here. And I hope that you got some benefit out of this week. And I hope to see you again sometime in the not too distant future. So thank you.